The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
That's what we're about. That's why we have an offensive coordinator in the form of a wealth management strategy, a defensive coordinator in terms of the best folks in the industry in the gold and silver space to help with this major transition ahead. 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, I'm willing to be patient because the numbers involved are almost unimaginably large.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, again, we're talking remote. I'm here in the studio. You are in the Airstream. I got a chance to sit with your family the other night when we were in Austin at one of the conferences and just really enjoy the fact that your four kids are getting to spend time with you on the road, you and Mary Catherine. And it makes me think of the things we have to be thankful for, being on the road with you guys and doing the conferences, meeting with, you know, some of our clients that have been with us 30 or 40 years. You know, it's a week to be thankful, isn't it?
It is. You know, five of the seven conferences we've done now over and over again, there's a sense in which, you know, not only are they grateful that we've come out to their areas and neck of the woods to spend some time with them and to give them an update, but we're just as grateful because we understand that the nature of our business, we wouldn't be in business if it wasn't for people transacting with us and extending that to us, that opportunity to serve them. And so we're in our 45th year of business as a metals brokerage company and asset management firm, and it's a real privilege for us. We certainly feel that gratefulness, that gratitude for the opportunity to partner with families intergenerationally.
You know, Dave, when I was sitting with you in the Airstream the other night before we went to all those food trucks there in Austin, you know, we just sort of had a progressive dinner, you and your dad and your family and the kids and some of the other people who work at the company. It was really an amazing thing. And when you told me, and it gave me back the memory that I had forgotten, that this was something that you did with your father going back 35, almost 40 years, where you guys were in a Winnebago when your dad was traveling and talking about the economy. It's sort of a full circle. You know, you talk about things in your legacy book, but this was truly seeing legacy replayed.
Yeah, it's definitely at a different life cycle or time in our family. I learned to walk in the Winnebago, whereas we don't have any kids that young, but it was my mom and dad, my older sister, our German Shepherd, and the road before us, the road behind us. It was an adventure for all. And, you know, few points of near insanity, I think probably for my mom, just dealing with kids and dog hair and all things practical. But in the end, great memory makers. And so we're super grateful to have this time together as a family. And that's good for them to see kind of what it is that we do on the road and to get to do that all together. It's been super rewarding.
Well, one of the things, too, that our clients are getting to see is what you've written about in your book, The Legacy. And I just want to mention for the listener that that's a book that's gotten almost exclusively five-star ratings on Amazon since you came out with it. And that legacy book is talking about things far more important than just financial legacy. It's talking about deliberate family action and redemption in a family. And so I would just like to encourage listeners, you know, at these conferences, you're selling out of the books that you bring, but I would encourage any listener who's interested in reading your book, Legacy, to get on Amazon, order the book if you like the book, or you know, if you don't like the book, go ahead and put a comment there on Amazon. But I can tell you, after working with your family for 30 years, that the things that you write about in the book, I can say are true. The stories that you've told about your family, the ups and the downs, and the redemption that's there, definitely, it makes for a great Christmas gift for a person who's trying to add value to their family relationship.
You know, Kevin, we got to spend time with clients who've read through it, poured through it, shared copies with siblings and with their kids and grandkids even, and that has been one of the things they've commented to me. The reason they ordered a book or a half a case or whatever was so that they could stuff stockings this year and continue a conversation, hopefully engage a conversation across generations on the topics that are most vital to extending legacy, the legacy that you want from one generation to the next. So pretty excited about that, pretty excited to see how it's been received and the impact that it's having on people's lives. Because frankly, the big surprise for me is that it's not just content and ideas to chew on, but there's some things in there that people are finding really transformational and something that sort of represents a hard stop in terms of the way they thought about life prior to, and in sort of an enthusiastic way of looking at things differently moving forward.
Well, and I think, you know, you're even surprised because a lot of the things and the takeaways that are happening with people are really bigger than what you had in mind. I mean, you just were simply telling a story, but it's amazing how people can start to relate and start to utilize that type of thing. Dave, I'm going to go ahead and move to the events of the week because we see, talk about a replay full circle. We've been seeing manipulations in the gold market. We saw a replay day before yesterday of what we talked about last week. Last week, if you'll recall, you talked about $4 billion worth of gold being dumped into the market all at once to purposely push the price down for whatever reason. And then day before yesterday, on Monday, we saw the same exact thing. It was just about half that size. 15,000 futures contracts were dumped on Monday. It was about $2 billion worth of gold just instantly dumped into the market. Now, of course, the market has recovered since then, but what are your thoughts on that? Is it that they're afraid of 1300, or is somebody just trying to buy at a cheaper price?
You know, I think Volcker made it clear that the importance of the gold price is it signals no confidence vote within the system, whether that's relating to our system of debt or the stability of our currency. Where you see traffic into the metals, people are basically saying, I don't like what I see. I think I'd like to opt out, and I want to do it in a way that gives me some insulation. Historically speaking, this is an asset, a currency form, which has never gone to zero, and makes sense to just sort of step aside for a while. So that's what an increase in the price of gold is really signaling, and why Volcker was so emphatic that his one mistake in the 70s was not hammering the gold price. Now, you might say, well, that's discouraging because it just means it's more of a target now than ever before. What is encouraging to me is that with each intervention in the market, you see less and less impact. So $100, $150 decline circa 2013-14, fast forward to 2015, and it's more like a $50 or $30 decline. And now you can wallop the price 10, 15 bucks on the day, and it costs you a lot of money to do it. $1.94 billion, 15,000 contracts, that's what was dumped on Monday morning in the fraction of a second. And, you know, certainly it had an impact on the price, but here we are, buoying back even to those same levels. And what I love to see is that the free markets ultimately have their day in the sun, even while manipulators can have and have had their day already. So moving forward, I see it as an impact that is less and less significant.
We're in an environment of record highs, and last Tuesday, the utilities, they surged to record highs. But we have record highs occurring in just about everything right now. And so you've got this gold manipulation on the one side, and then you have Bitcoin on the same exact day going up to a record high of $8,200. You want to talk about some of the record highs and what those are signaling for the future?
Yeah, I'm not complaining by any stretch. I mean, one of the things that we've shared in the conferences with folks is that we've hit record highs in household net worth. So as the utilities average surged to record highs last week, we've got record highs in net worth. We've got record highs in the bond market, at least in the last 12 to 16 months. We've got record highs in stocks and other indexes. We've got record highs in art, $400 million purchase for a Da Vinci.
The Da Vinci, yeah.
Record highs in Bitcoin, as you said, over 8,000. I'm sure there's no coincidence in the bubbling up of prices or there being a reason for caution. You know, you've got a brave new world of people shooting the moon in almost every category.
Often, Dave, you've talked about not investing with your feelings. And a lot of times when you have record highs going on, the feeling is that a person needs to jump in. You mentioned a few weeks ago that the fear in the market right now is not fear of it going down, but fear of missing out. So people quickly forget that there's a market feeling that permeates and influences the prices.
Yeah, and that's the operative feeling, which is either bullish, I mean, you might call that greedy, the positive element driving prices higher. Again, I'm not complaining. It is what it is. But I think we know where we are in the cycle of things because the other side of that equation is bearish and where people are more concerned, focusing on asset preservation. But when you recognize where you're at in a cycle and you're getting to new highs, which do represent a certain form of an extreme, what do we suggest? reducing exposures, raising cash, mm-hmm. diversifying into real wealth out of assets with temporary prices that have reached those unsustainable levels. Of course, high can go higher, just like low can go lower. When you're thinking of buying a market low, it can go even lower. I'm not saying sell everything, no, but the future is never what you think it will be entirely. So hedging your bets is wise. I've routinely circled back around to Rogoff's comments on the cryptocurrency market. Just, you know, again, it's an area that has gone high and will continue to go higher, but Rogoff's comments on Bitcoin are certainly sobering. He said in a recent Project Syndicate article, but the long history of currency tells us that what the private sector innovates, the state eventually regulates and appropriates, and there is no reason to expect virtual currency to avoid a similar fate. He said that back on October 9th in that Project Syndicate article.
Well, and it's interesting, Dave, at these conferences, when we go to question and answer, one of the first two, maybe three questions has to do with Bitcoin. I know that the people who are asking the questions aren't necessarily invested in Bitcoin, but it's been such a phenomenal bubble, if you can call it that, or it's been such a phenomenal rise that people are intrigued even if they're not attracted. And, you know, with what Rogoff is saying, it's obvious that the government at some point will have to do something about it, because the government themselves is not going to give up the biggest business of any government, and that's printing your own money, being able to borrow in your own money and pay yourself back in money that you can print. You can't do that with Bitcoin.
That's a pretty valuable franchise, and sort of currency monopoly status is not something that governments in the past have given up without something of a fight. So if a technology fixation causes you to ignore the history of monetary monopolies, to ignore warring states, to ignore the nature of governmental control, then I'd say that you're not at the cutting edge of the future, but probably on the knife's edge of the past. Governments routinely gut their citizenry like fish. Of course, if it serves their interests, that's when it happens. But we should always remember that as valuable as the distributed ledger and the blockchain system is, it's not the private sector that's in control of the kill switches on the internet. Ultimate control of the internet is in the hands of governments. So if bits are private today, right? That's the part where you can keep it offline, but their movement is anything but private. You've got 900, now this is cumulative since 2011, 2012, 980,000 bitcoins which have been hacked and stolen. What makes you think the NSA or some other governmental group can't completely co-opt the cryptocurrency universe, just as Rogoff has suggested?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The people that I've talked to who absolutely don't want to hear about Bitcoin being anything but a valid market, they usually don't have much market information or history. What they're doing is they're looking at a new technological boom. Dave, it reminds me a lot of talking to people in 1998 and 1999 about the dot-com bubble, when stocks got to be so ridiculously overvalued. You know, the price-earnings ratios were to the moon. People were saying, well, don't you understand? This is the advent of the internet. This is a new world. It's new means of valuation. It's not a bubble. Now, of course, we learned differently in March of 2000 in the NASDAQ. Really, many of those companies never recovered. So it is interesting that you've got a technology that you'll see, and you've pointed this out in the conferences. This blockchain technology is an amazing technology that the government will use to their advantage at some point. It's like a beta test, like Tesla when they're beta testing the models that drive themselves. In a way, Bitcoin is being beta tested for something further that probably will be government controlled.
Yeah, the blockchain is incredibly valuable. It's just the iterations, which today we see them growing in popularity, various tokens and coins, which may not exist 5 years from now. That's a big question.
Right. Well, you know, talking about government monopolies, we're seeing this Senate tax plan coming through, and it's strange that the monopoly of, let's call it government and corporation, which is a monopoly unto itself, you could even call it fascism, where big business is favored by the government and small business is not. You know, the Senate tax plan is making the individual, you and I, tax breaks temporary, but the corporate tax breaks, sounds like they're going to be permanent.
Yeah. Who are you working for is the question that comes to mind. And it's a question that comes to mind when I think about our representative form of government. Times have changed since the original formulation of an idea, whether it's Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, Washington, because the answer today is not we the people. From the LA Times, the Senate tax plan, they report, makes the individual tax breaks temporary, while corporate tax breaks would be permanent. And so, you know, who are they working for? That becomes obvious. It's kind of a combination of democracy slash kleptocracy. So the demo-kleptocracy serves corporate interests over individual interests. And that really is because K Street lobbyists are the voice. They are the voice of our representatives here. And I'd love to see the electorate express disdain and intolerance for that sort of corporatist, what classically was defined as fascist, where you can't tell the difference between big government and big business, but that corporatist system that we're perpetuating. And it's fascinating to me that Republicans actually make the best fascists, because they can't see the difference between governmental and commercial interests, and they're only too happy to blur the lines. I mean, Democrats make no bones about being anti-business, and even amongst the elite within the Democratic Party, the Clintons prove that they can work for themselves, which is not necessarily anti-business, it's just kind of pure corruption. That's a very, I mean, that's a different kettle of stinking fish, where business can be co-opted for personal gain, even while in public office.
Well, Dave, you know, I would say that I'm a conservative, okay? I am a conservative because I believe in free rights. I believe in small business. But it's embarrassing at this point, in many ways, to call myself a Republican, because the Republican Party has turned into a fascist party, like you're saying. The qualifications of a conservative years ago really was a benefit to the individual, and now the individual is being ruled out for the corporation. So the party really ought to be renamed.
That's right, because there is this sickening element within the Republican Party, and certainly this does not represent all Republicans, but that sickening element within the party is that big business has co-opted big government Republicans and then gone on to abuse the small business and entrepreneurship language as if they are actually for the little guy and champions of a small to medium enterprise.
And that's not true.
Right. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Look at how they're treating pass-through entities. The little guy's getting screwed while big business gets the tax reduction benefits. And there's a vast difference between big business and small business. And, I mean, on this point, let me start and finish with this. Velocity of money is surprisingly low. And I'm just going to speculate here, but it's surprisingly low in part to the sucking of local dollars out of local economies back into the tax and spend jurisdictions where big business is centered. When you look at mom-and-pop businesses, they may not be the largest employers or represent massive jobs growth, but they tend to save and spend locally, which sets off a very different economic virtue. What am I talking about? Higher circulation of dollars and thus improved velocity on a small scale. So is it possible? Is it possible that we have business conversion towards monopoly-type status? Again, big business status. Can we thank them for the ever-diminishing velocity of money numbers that we've seen? And is it possible that, in turn, our credit and monetary policies, we're talking about easy money, of course, has exacerbated the sort of merger and acquisition consolidation, and thus, on a broad scale, much lower velocity? And so we look at low economic growth in this period, and we say, well, velocity is not a constant, as it was assumed to be. It's been significantly lower. Dollars spent are not being recycled through the economy. Why is that? Where are they going? Why aren't they being re-spent? I want to tell you, I think one of the reasons, if you look at sort of Amazon and its impact, there's a lot more of dollars spent in a particular locale than in all the locations where products used to be bought and sold on a more localized basis.
Oh, that's very obvious as we travel. You know, the talk right now, there's several things going on. I remember a gentleman asking a question when we were in Austin, Dave, and he's a family man. He's raising children, and he's realizing that most of the jobs that people are working in right now will somehow either be automated or Amazoned out of business. And so he asked you the question, what in the world do I teach my kids? What do I do now so that I can prepare them for the future? And, you know, the other side of the coin, some of the cities that we visited are possible on the list for an Amazon distribution center. And, you know, the talk there is like, oh my gosh, we need to buy real estate here because that's the wave of the future, you know, to quote your dad. So we have this concern of automation and Amazonization on the one side. And then on the other side, the only real economic benefit is for the person who's packing the box for Amazon in one of the cities that's chosen as a major distribution center.
Well, you know, at the same time, I look at, from a big picture perspective, things that signal to me coming ever closer to a recession. You've got the yield curve flattening here in the United States. We've talked about interest rates coming up here in the tail end of the fourth quarter. In other parts of the world, you're actually having an inversion of the yield curve where your short rates are higher than your long rates. And that's always been a precursor to recession.
Isn't that something that Ben Bernanke has talked extensively about?
Well, and other economists, too. They've generally held that yield curve inversions are a precursor to recession. And frankly, flattening of the yield curve gets you there, with inversion not being absolutely necessary. We're talking about, again, short rates rising, short-term duration rates rising, even as long rates stay at a lower level. You've got the year-end hikes. Should they go through with them, they do flatten the U.S. yield curve. China's already inverted, as I mentioned. In 2006, this was the case here in the United States, as it has been the case in the preceding seven recessions, where inversions were a signal which told you what was coming. Of course, there's other things that would signal and complement it, too. Collapse in housing starts, a variety of things which we have not seen yet, which we'll keep our eyes out for. But now the Treasury curve is at 10-year lows. You go back, you look at the recessions of the 90s, you look at the recessions of the 2000s, and those recessions came anywhere from 2 to 24 months following yield curve inversion. February 2006 was the inversion. Recession wasn't made official for another 22 months from that time. But I look at China as one of those places which, again, perhaps if they catch a cold, we feel it here in the United States most acutely. It's become that way in an interconnected world. And, you know, China, even more disturbing than their yield curve inversion, is the growth in popularity of securitized assets, up 61% from last year, likely to hit $170 billion U.S. dollar equivalent, according to the Financial Times. What are we talking about in terms of securitized assets? This is like our garbage repackaging back in 2006 to 2008, where we took mortgages, we took credit card loans, we took auto loans.
Yeah, you remember all the acronyms. You just cut those things up into pieces and sell them as a security. Nobody really knows what they are.
That's right. We rebundle them, we resell them. And look, I mean, maybe the Chinese are more careful in their construction of credit instruments, but the reality is these are like grab bags. You've got a smorgasbord of anything that couldn't sell individually, which sells a lot easier on a collective sort of, call it communist soup. You bring the stone, I'll bring the whatever.
Yeah, it reminds me of the book when I was a kid. A lot of people have read it. It's called Stone Soup. Okay, you bring the water, we'll bring the stone. And then everybody is hoping at that point that all the better ingredients will be added from the outside. Well, speaking of that, okay, if indeed we are 2 to 22 months from the next major recession, one of the ways that we've been able to delay the recession so far has been with the expansion of credit. Now, the IMF says over the next 5 years that the expansion of credit is going to be ridiculous. $45 trillion is what they're estimating in the expansion of credit. So could they delay this recession just by going further and further into debt?
Well, not only delay recession, but take asset prices literally to the moon. I mean, $45 trillion over a five-year period, $18 trillion in credit expansion in the United States, $27 trillion in China, nearly doubling their current credit markets to $54 trillion total in a five-year period. That's astounding. Expansions within the asset price markets, which perhaps we've never seen in history. And yet, I'm concerned that we're playing with fire here. You know, recession may bring the consumer back into the pit of despair, and we may see that happen before we see this massive credit expansion that the IMF has suggested or talked about. But, you know, if the consumer goes back on strike, you're going to see massive credit growth, but it's going to come from governments primarily, which forces the issue of how you can fund explosive budget deficits and maintain currency stability. There's a whole host of things that come in sort of a domino-like effect once government is the spender of last resort. And I don't think it's going to be the consumer stepping up and driving economic growth, economic activity, or even credit growth unless they're, you know, really fortified and made more comfortable with their economic realities by a significant improvement in income.
Well, something that I'm seeing again, Dave, I mean, we saw this back before the crisis in 2008. Households are running their credit cards up like mad again. I mean, household debt seems to be on the increase.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a combination of things. When you're talking about household debt, it did reach a new peak. It's at now $280 billion above the 2008 third quarter high, which was the record up to that point in U.S. history. The New York Fed reports that they've seen gains both in mortgages, auto debt, and in student debt, which brings us to the current number of $12.96 trillion, with the largest percentage increases coming on credit cards. And who knows, maybe that's a pre-Black Friday surge. Maybe it's just cash-strapped Americans or tapping credit by necessity. But MarketWatch, the news group, comments on the household credit card and auto debt portions. You know, they're looking at a surge of roughly $116 billion, that increase. And here's the shocker. Here's the shocker. Credit card and auto delinquencies, according to them, are rising at a disturbing rate. They've commented, too, on the student loan delinquencies, but pointed out something very curious. It's difficult to wrap your head around the student loan delinquencies because you've got 10%, which they know are in default. Harder to figure out on the rest because half of those loans, you know, we're talking about $1.4 trillion total, so about $700 billion are in deferment or in forbearance. So, again, just tougher to say. You can't call those non-performing when they're in deferment or in forbearance because they're not technically in default or non-performing, but could easily be recategorized as such.
Well, yeah, everybody's going into debt. I mean, deficit spending for the government last month, $63 billion. You'd think that that wouldn't be the case if we're taking in more tax revenue.
Well, and that's the crazy thing, because when you're running a $63 billion deficit in the month of October, October is a little bit like April in terms of tax collecting. You get a big pop in the numbers. So the Treasury collected a record amount of taxes in October, but still ran, as you mentioned, $63 billion deficit for the month. I think that the deficit spending theme is definitely a 2018 to 2020 issue with some potential major implications for the U.S. dollar as our foreign creditors and perhaps the appetite for U.S. credit diminishes.
Well, talk about insatiable appetites. I mean, we talk about individual debt going up right now, hitting records. Government deficits continue to rise. And, you know, the corporations, they seem to also have an insatiable desire to borrow money right now.
Well, Bloomberg had a fascinating article on that last week, Kevin, sounding the alarms on rising corporate leverage. And what is corporate leverage other than debts on the balance sheet growing disproportionately to the assets of the corporation? So even as investors are actually turning away from the corporate debt markets all over the world, and we've even seen outflows from junk bonds, $4.4 billion this last week, which was higher than usual than in recent weeks. Maybe investors are done with chasing yield. We'll have to see. Maybe they're just locking in gains from their credit exposures as they head into year end. But here's the deal. You've got Yellen, you've got Draghi, you've got central bankers who are suggesting a rising interest rate environment with quantitative tightening. Now, the opposite side of the equation, everyone knows QE or quantitative easing. Quantitative tightening is the new description, which may be what we're beginning to see on the front edge of inflated bond prices coming back to earth, yields beginning to rise again. Again, we're seeing that particularly in the longer maturity paper and in the junk bonds, which we kind of think of as the hold-your-nose credit segments.
Well, Dave, if that corporate borrowing was to actually make the corporations more productive, we might actually have hope. But as you brought out in the past, a lot of that corporate borrowing is just simply to come in and buy up the shares of that corporation to decrease the shares on the market and increase the earnings per share. Is that a game that they're still playing?
Yeah, that's the perception game, and that's where a lot of corporate leverage has gone. It's a big component in that perception game played with earnings per share. So you get the money for free or nearly free in the credit markets, buy back your shares, this is the embarrassing part, at record prices, and by shrinking the shares outstanding, you can more easily meet or beat your earnings per share guidance from earlier in the quarter. So the corporate balance sheet is worse for it. But those same executives selling their own shares, what they hold of the company, insider selling is on the rise. it allows them to satisfy investor greed on the one hand, driving prices higher through your earnings per share manipulation and attracting new investors in on the basis of quote-unquote outperformance on an earnings per share basis, while at the same time they're extracting value for themselves through insider selling of shares. And it's strange to me how no one connects the dots between insider selling of shares and the use of a corporation's treasury to go out and buy shares back. I would love to see a rule in place. If I were the new sheriff in town cleaning things up on Wall Street or in corporate America, I would want to see a rule in place that precludes insider liquidations within a 90 to 180 day window of corporate buybacks. That, I think, just makes sense.
Well, and Dave, I know that you're not a proponent of a lot of government regulation, but every once in a while, regulation is necessary, you know, when it comes to breaking up monopoly, like we talked about with Amazon. You know, also regulation as far as just outright abuse of the shareholder. It makes perfect sense that the government needs to step in at that point and have some say in the matter. Now, you know, when we were at these conferences, we met with several public servants from California. One gentleman in particular who has moved to Austin. He's a retired firefighter. His pension is coming from CalPERS, you know, the California Pension Fund. And lest we sound like we're always negative on the government, something positive happened recently with CalPERS, and they may be seeing the handwriting on the wall. They're moving away from their overextended stock exposure in that pension fund.
Yeah, it still is surprising to me, Kevin. I mean, in the private sector, everything's moved to 401ks, where you're basically responsible for your own retirement. And so you save what you're going to save with a company match and then have to be judicious about what you spend in retirement. And, you know, of course you have to be judicious if you're coming and drawing a pension, but it's just such a different world. I've talked with a family member here in Texas who works for the school district. And, you know, there are ways that you can stay within the system long enough to ultimately capture better than 100% of your last year's earnings. You just have to figure out how the system works and to some degree game it. And so that's what I don't understand. You spend 20, 25 years, which is a long time, in the job, but then you can live 30, 40 years beyond that and collect 100% of what you had earned in that 25 to 30 year period. I don't fault someone for wanting those benefits, but I look at the system and I just go, how does that work? Because in a company setting, that becomes totally non-sustainable. But, you know, to your point with the California pensioner that we got to meet with in Austin, very good news for the California pensioner. CalPERS is slashing its equity exposure from 50% to 34%.
Well, will that be good news or bad news for the markets in general, though? Because CalPERS is a large investor. I mean, if we were to see that across the board with pension funds, there's no buyers in that stock market. We could see a substantial downturn.
Well, fair enough. It's not good news for the markets, but it's very good news for the California pensioner if you're looking at kind of getting out of the market at or near a high. And, you know, of course, CalPERS is a large equity shareholder. And on a more significant basis, they're a beacon to many investors. You know, Bloomberg discusses the exit as very significant, and this is a trend which should occur given record valuation levels. This is how long-term tops are established. You end up with significant holders of the asset class, any asset class. They begin jettisoning that asset, in this case, shares of companies, and they do that ahead of the general public. Then the public, who's always looking backwards at performance and predicating the future on the past, you know, wakes up one day and prices are considerably lower, and they don't realize that some of your major holders, those who've been a repository, a long-term holder, they've already exited. And then you're left with weaker hands. Those weaker hands are what represent sort of the panic selling later on. But I look at what the general public's doing today, and we've talked about Vanguard, we've talked about the ETFs. Vanguard is absolutely loving this blind optimism because they see, and this year is no exception. Last year was a record year. Now this year's a record year. Another record year of investor dollars plunging into unmanaged funds. $350 billion in flows this year for Vanguard. And you get institutional investors, again, who are looking ahead. They see the implications of overvaluation. They're beginning to lighten their exposures. Good for them. It's a fiduciary responsibility. But the public is marching to the beat of a very different drummer.
Well, and the public's being handed a bag by the institutional investors at a 31 P.E. ratio. I mean, the Shiller cyclically adjusted P.E. ratio now, 31. That's the second highest in history, Dave, and it always hits these types of numbers before a crash.
Yeah, investment committees at pension funds and insurance companies don't always get it right. Sometimes they get it very wrong, but they do understand the high math involved in the rolling average of the 10-year P.E. Shiller popularized it, otherwise known as CAPE, cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple. And you're right, at 31, what it implies is a number that high, a 10-year average annual return. The next 10 years, average annual return, 0% in equities. I mean, basically the market's too high to offer rewards. It's too high to offer rewards for future growth because that future growth is already in today's price.
Right.
And it would require extraordinary circumstances to drive prices higher and valuation metrics even further into the stratosphere.
Well, and it's not just price of the share to earnings, the P.E. ratio, that's hitting all-time highs. I mean, Warren Buffett has an indicator that he uses, and right now it's at all-time highs as well.
You've got the Buffett indicator, which is GDP to stock market capitalization, that ratio. Never been higher. You get price to sales, which is at all-time highs. I mean, all of this, what does it say? It's just that we either move sideways in price for a number of years or we're on the edge of a major correction in equities. Dare we call it a crash? I mean, this is, on the flip side, you know, earlier in our conversation, Kevin, we're talking about the IMF's estimates of credit market growth of $45 trillion over 5 years. We're on the cusp of a market crash, and yet for unhealthy reasons, we could see the Dow double from here. What's it going to be? This is the craziness of not a manic market, but it's also a very dangerous market because brains are not engaged. We talked about ETFs a minute ago and the amount of money that's flowing into Vanguard. That is unmanaged, unrisk mitigated assets flowing into the stock market on the belief that you don't need to be intellectually engaged in the process of investing. In fact, the market gives you reward if you just get in line. Granted, it'd be the first time in world history that that's the case, but that's the belief supporting this rampant move towards ETF investing, as if differentiation and careful studies of individual companies was not necessary for success.
Well, people are scratching their heads right now, Dave, very intelligent people, and they're saying, well, if this is the case, do we really even want managed money if you no longer have to be discerning? So there's got to be a bright side to this, though, Dave, because if the money manager right now is out of vogue and everybody just herding into the same investments is in vogue, then when that reverses, it seems that we have two bright sides. One is for the gold holder who's sitting this out waiting for better valuations. The other is that better valuation in the equity market.
Well, I mean, it's back to a world where you are rewarded for work. And the investment process is a thoughtful process, and it's hard work. And since 2012, it's been completely unrewarding. The harder you work, it's not the luckier you get, but the dumber you appear to be. And that's the way it's been for every macro manager, for every mutual fund manager out there, because the only thing that has worked effectively is riding an index higher on a sea of easy money. So you're right. On the bright side, gold owners in that mean reverting period will be ringside once again for market action, the likes of which we haven't seen in 3 to 5 years. And for those with patience, in the end, there is reward. And for those that lack patience, I promise you, it's a double regret. It's a double regret. After stabilizing and moving higher in the 2016 to 2017 timeframe, you get the price of gold, which may now benefit from having investment inflows from investors who are experiencing more normal market volatility. Do we have normal market volatility yet today? No. Are we anticipating it? Absolutely. Absolutely. And a part of it is because there's components within the market which are beyond the control of the Fed. They're tied specifically to vulnerable positions in equities and a vulnerable psychology which supports it. You look at the margin debt numbers, which were pegging at new all-time nominal highs 6-12 months ago, $551 billion, right? And now we're at even higher numbers, $606 billion, according to Alan Newman. This is the ticking time bomb in the stock market. You get a downside correction in motion and wonder where the massive liquidations comes from? You've got a half a trillion, over half a trillion dollars in forced liquidations. Now, realistically, it's only 50 to 60% of that number which would be forced to liquidate. But it's still very large numbers. Markets are made at the margins. Therefore, $200, $300, $400 billion in liquidations in equities, you know what? It has a huge impact. It's not a dollar-for-dollar impact. It's a disproportionate impact.
You know, and every major market downturn in stocks, Dave, has always been preceded by this margin debt hitting a new high.
Right, and then one slides and they both slide together, sort of a self-reinforcing price vortex.
Okay, so we were talking about the pension funds possibly starting to move out and hand the bag over to the investor. But the traders, the professional traders, are not moving to the exits at this point.
Part of that is because they're still banking on central bank largesse. They believe that central banks have got their back, and they are ignoring the warning signs. They're buying every dip, at least the last 10 to 20 days. Every time we've had a dip in price, you've had folks step in and buy the dip. And maybe that's the freedom that they feel playing with other people's money. Maybe it's a consequence of cheap finance. Combining those two into some sort of a speculative cocktail, their heads are spinning. You know, Wall Street managers, the fascinating thing is that they're 100% invested. They're leveraging up to buy more on the dips. And a part of that is they fear that their performance heading into year end is going to fall behind in a peer group. It's a very fascinating investment environment because you get active managers, not the passive ETF guys, but the active managers who are being discouraged from moving to cash on pain of being fired because of concerns over relative performance lapses. So instead, you've got the average institutional manager now who's carrying a portfolio which is 102% long.
Wow.
It's fascinating.
That can only be done with debt. When you're 102% long, you are beyond 100% exposed. You're just hanging it all out.
And of course, that's an average. But, you know, we had last week, which was options expiration. And, you know, if we don't set significant new market highs in these indexes within days, we could be putting in a market top. To get waning enthusiasm, again, amongst a few institutions, CalPERS being a really big one, and that's typically followed by a more spirited exit from positions by those who don't necessarily know why they're selling, except that the price is going down and they better sell. And that margin number is certainly forcing the issue at some point.
Okay, but this is the big question in my mind, Dave. We've got algorithms that have been set to buy at different levels, and the algorithms seem to be running the market, you know, high frequency trading, you know, 70, 80% of the market at times. So is there a time when these spirit exits from positions really have no buyers? I mean, where there's no bid because, say, the algorithm is overwhelmed.
Well, I think that's the new world that we're in. We can imagine a lot of profit-taking into year-end if folks want to secure good numbers for 2017 performance. And that profit-taking may, at a certain threshold, overwhelm the algorithms. As you described, smoothing out the declines, intervening on the downside. But when we get the collapse in the market, I think a part of the post-mortem is going to tie to the inadequacy of the new regime, the new algorithm trading machine, trading settlements there in market dark pools. We assume that they can match all buys and sells, and we assume that they are doing that with greater efficiency. That's the sales pitch that's been made by these dark pools that are settling trades today. But if you have a preponderance of liquidations, sells, and only a limited number of people stepping in to buy, what we're going to get to witness, and I think this is all a part of a postmortem that's talked about in 2018, 2019, 2020, is that we've had a re-engineering of the system already.
Right, like the Volcker rule. I mean, Buchstaber, who is a regular guest of ours, was helpful with writing the Volcker rule, and then he turned around and said, oh my gosh, we may have created a monster.
That's right. Post-decimalization, post-Volcker rule, in which there are hardly any market makers left to warehouse, to inventory shares, this time is not different due to a changed set of market drivers. You know, greed-oriented or fear-oriented investors, I think those are always going to be there. But the backdrop into which the fear dynamic plays it has been altered, and I don't think there's very many market participants that appreciate the reengineering that's taken place. This is going to be the first significant decline we have with an absence of market makers. So who might become the buyer of last resort in that environment? I hate to say it, but it's probably the Fed. We've seen the Bank of Japan step in and fill that role for the Nikkei. And is the next major balance sheet explosion or expansion at the Fed to accommodate a radically different asset class? Again, no longer mortgage-backed securities or treasuries or corporates, as we've seen with the ECB, or ETF, stock ETFs, as we've seen with the Bank of Japan, but direct investment in the U.S. stock market by the Fed. They may be forced to be the buyer of last resort.
Well, and that's the thing that's made this so difficult. You know, Dave, you were talking about the harder you work, the dumber you look when you're in the investment field right now. You know, the smartest of the smart guys, the guys who understand history, the guys who know how to do analysis of the balance sheet, they're all losing to just the general herding of putting everything into, say, a Vanguard. But what we have is a complete lack of price discovery. And the beauty of the market is that we actually can see the appropriate price between a buyer and a seller that they can agree to, unless there's a third party coming in and buying everything. That's what we've seen in Europe. That's what we've seen with the Bank of Japan. That's what we're seeing here. So this buyer of last resort, I guess the only thing that would stop it from happening is the inability to continue to borrow and print.
You know, I remember sitting at dinner with a bond fund manager. He owned his own business and had been trading bonds for 35, 40 years. And, you know, he thought that the pricing dynamics in the bond market were getting crazy. This is 4 years ago. 4 years ago. And there was an offer on the table. Somebody wanted to buy his company, and they did. Very, very healthy. Eight figures, and happy to walk away and retire, happy to move directly into the gold market at that point, and happy to sit and wait. Because one of the things that he knows, being in the business for 30 to 40 years, is that what he was looking at and what he was trading at on a daily basis was no longer tied to reality. So you've had a massive distortion in prices within the bond market. What could drive greater distortions in the stock market? And again, we go back to central bank interventions. You've got $11 trillion in sovereign and corporate bonds, which are trading today with yields less than zero. And that is a distortion created by the central bank community. We may see even greater distortions in other asset classes. It's a mania. But I'm betting the surprise element of a no-bid market is enough to scare the whiskers off any Wall Street alley cat. And I think the opportunities on the short side will at some point open up considerably. Now, I mean, we've got rough patches in the past if you look at a November to December time frame. And I'm not saying there's a symmetry here, but there's an interesting frequency where November to December, you end up with a real rough patch in the stock market. This is 2017. Where were we at in 2007? Bit of a rough patch, November to December. Bit of a rough patch if you roll the clock back to 1997. Bit of a rough patch if you move back to 87. Bit of a rough patch if you move back to 57, 47, 1937, 1917, 1907, 1897, 1887. All of these saw a very difficult environment late in the fourth quarter. I don't know if 2017 is going to be the same, but we will see.
Isn't that interesting? What a strange pattern. So in a 10-year stretch, that which is the seventh year has more often than not been a rough patch between November to December. Who can explain why that would happen? But it is an interesting observation.
You're seeing some revelation of weakness within individual companies. You know, we've got General Electric, who's sold off over 45% since the beginning of the year. They were considered sort of a bellwether, almost a mutual fund in one company, if you will. And, you know, I'm reminded, as we kind of wrap our comments today, I'm reminded of the importance of moving from one asset thematic to another at a critical juncture. You know, roll the clock back to the year 2000. I'm working with Morgan Stanley. I go to a special meeting at the Ritz-Carlton in Pasadena, California, where some of the larger blue blood holders of General Electric shares were invited. Pasadena is a fairly ritzy part of Southern California. And again, some of the very wealthy families, largest shareholders in GE are in that neighborhood. And, you know, This was actually the first year that I bought gold as an adult, selling for around $300 an ounce. And I remember GE in that time frame because I began to think, I can choose one or I can choose the other. What do I want to have? A cross-section of corporate America or something that is, in this sense, alternative? I looked at $30,000, which was a modest investment at the time, but it was either 100 ounces of gold or 500 shares of General Electric. And I opted for the 100 ounces of gold instead of 500 shares of General Electric. Now, you fast forward to the present day, and this is, again, why a transference of value is so important and why catching some of these big thematics is so critical. I'm not opposed to owning General Electric shares. I think today, I mean, if I wanted to, I could own 15 times the number of shares.
With that same 100 ounces of gold?
Yeah, if I move from my 100 ounces of gold, currently 127,000, you know, at $17 a share, that pencils out to about 7,500 shares. So I'm up from 500 shares of GE up to 7,500 shares. And yes, I've had to be patient for the last 17 years, but it's not very often that in 17 years of practicing patience, you get to increase your financial footprint 15 times. I'm still holding out. I'm holding out because I think ultimately the transference of gold at, say, $2,000 or $3,000 an ounce into GE shares. Frankly, there's other companies which I may prefer in the future, but I just remember GE because that's where I was in the year 2000, and that's what I decided to put in motion was ounces of gold. Fast forward into the future. I don't know what the future is, but I think gold's, let's say $2,000, just to keep it conservative. $2,000 an ounce, GE shares, I think in that same context, are 10 or less. Mm. And this is what's fascinating. At that price, this is now easy math, $2,000 gold divided by $10 a share, I can now own, or then, future tense, own 20,000 shares. Think about that.
Yeah, that's a 40-fold return by holding gold until you bought the GE shares versus buying the GE shares and holding on to them instead.
Oh, and by the way, if we're just counting the new adjusted GE dividends of 12 cents a quarter, yeah, you're looking at $9,600 a year in dividend income off of what was an original $30,000 investment. $9,600 a year in dividend income from GE on what was originally a $30,000 investment. So I like these massive transfers of wealth, and if you can ride the right horse during the duration of a race, even if it requires some patience in the interim, this has been almost 20 years. But the numbers are already working. 7,500 shares, if I wanted it now, that's what I can have. I'm holding out for something closer to 20 or 30,000 shares for the same dollars invested. And I think for the patient investor, that's what we're about. That's why we have an offensive coordinator in the form of a wealth management strategy, a defensive coordinator in terms of the best folks in the industry in the gold and silver space to help move from one asset class to the next and ferry value from secured and safe asset classes like gold and silver into the land, plant, and infrastructure of productive companies in America. I'm looking forward to that transfer. I think it's going to happen. And I'm just glad that, again, as we finish where we started the conversation today, I'm glad that we're working with tens of thousands of clients across the country to help them with this major transition ahead. 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, I'm willing to be patient because the numbers involved are almost unimaginably large.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Just a reminder, we still have two of the seven conferences left. Come see us in Naples, Florida, or in Orlando, Florida, over the next couple of weeks. Give us a call at 800-525-9556 for more details, or visit us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.